Hello and welcome to another episode of Video Game Logic. Today's episode was recorded on April the 9th, 2024. I'm your host, gaming psychologist, and with me, as always, teaching someone how to sneak.
Fiend Rage.
On today's show, we're going to talk about a couple of games that we played. Stop Killing Games is a new campaign to prevent publishers from taking their titles offline. And we're going to talk about how hidden Nazi symbols were the tip of a toxic iceberg at Life is Strange developer Deck 9. Timestamps will be in the show notes following their respective topics. Hello, Rage.
Hello.
What's shaking, Megan?
Well, it turns out it's a naked woman on the front of a local bus.
Right. Naked lady on a bus and a topless lady in my office. Franken content. Lovingly recorded for you over the last... What are you at right now in this recording time so far, Craig? 40 minutes.
No, you're breaking the illusion. We've just started recording.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. But yes. Yes. And we talked for a little bit before we even pulled Craig up.
What, we talked? Since when?
Yeah. Since forever ago, because we love each other.
Bad touch, bad touch.
Yeah.
Just go to sit there and look disapprovingly at you.
Yep. I don't know. I don't know where my brain is going for the moment. I didn't yawn. I just kind of like stared. I've got some Legos sitting beside me. Just like a box of random Legos, because I'm using Legos to build like some sort of random kind of set piece things for a D&D session. Yeah. They're going to be used like once, and I don't want to 3D print like some terrain pieces that are going to get used once and then just like sit around for me going like, how can I reuse this oddly specific like layout for like a jumping puzzle? So, Legos. That was my solution. I could shake the box for dramatic effect. Ready? ASMR.
I'm not sure if it's just me, but I didn't hear a goddamn thing.
Oh, really? Did the noise filter catch it?
I think so.
It showed up on my recording on Audacity. I guess the Discord noise filter caught it.
Well, hopefully we don't have to use our backup recording.
Yeah, then you can hear the ASMR.
Well, I can't.
How do you... Let's just derail immediately, because now that I've done that, I'm curious. How do you personally feel about ASMR? Are you an ASMR boy?
It feels really creepy for most of it.
I hate ASMR. There are certain sounds that I do like, but like the ASMR bit, I'm like, mm-hmm. I don't like this. It makes me feel wrong inside.
Yeah, there's some of it that, okay, I get. Yeah, it's not for me, but yeah, I get how, yeah, somebody might like, yeah, listen to whispering or something, but then there's some of the weird shit that is... Feels like it's more like a fetish thing.
Yeah.
Like one of the top ASMR channels on YouTube. And the reason why I know this is because one of the cooking channels that follow was talking about how YouTube's algorithm is forcing female creators out. And one of the top YouTube channels in the top, I think 10 or 20. She was going through and showing how many guys versus girls, and yeah, right? Yeah. It is a slime ASMR, and it just seems so gross.
Yeah, that does feel grody. I also like, I doubly, especially triply hate like the eating thing. What is that called? Mukbang? Is that what that's called?
I hate that. Yeah, that's... as a fat guy, if I needed to watch somebody eat far too much, there's this little thing called a mirror.
Oh, buddy. I mean, I'm right there with you, but... Oh, buddy. Like, it doesn't... Like, I don't feel weird or grossed out watching people eat, like, normally. Like, that's something mm-hmm. that happens every day. I eat lunch with my coworkers. I eat dinner with my family. Like, whatever.
Yeah, but this is extreme eating, you know?
Yeah. It's very weird to me. So, yeah.
Now, seeing somebody, you know, like, trying a bunch of things is a little bit different than that. You know, it's not them gorging themselves.
Yeah.
There's a couple channels that I watch that has, like, they'll try various things from, like, okay, this is gonna sound hilarious, but let's go for it anyway. There's this gay Japanese couple that I watch occasionally, and they'll get like all the seasonal treats from 7-Eleven, which outside of context it sounds like seasonal treats from 7-Eleven. Sounds a little odd, but Japanese 7-Elevens are absolutely amazing. Just convenience stores in Japan are completely different from U.S. ones. Yo, there's no, like, mummified hot dogs that's been on the roller since the service station came into existence, right?
Yeah, since it first opened its doors in 1982.
Hey, wait a goddamn minute here.
But I have seen some, like, some travel videos and stuff that show off, like, Japanese convenience stores. They feel more like fancy bodegas than what I think of as, like, a gas station or a convenience store in the South. Like, there are some nicer places here, but, like, we don't have anything like a bodega here. Yeah, in cities, we don't have I mean, I'm sure there's one somewhere, right? I can't say that there's not any, but going to Chattanooga, Nashville, Knoxville pretty frequently, I've never seen a bodega. So
yeah, and also, you know, the Japanese convenience stores, they're lacking, you know, the 27 different varieties of boner pills.
Right. Because you can get those in the vending machines.
Right next to the used underwear.
Absolutely. And the canned porn farts.
And the canned coffee.
Don't get the two mixed up.
Actually, there's a cultural reason why there's so many vending machines. It's something I found fascinating. Essentially, there was a huge deregulation on vending machines. And companies basically tried to take as much advantage of it as they could. And would let basically put vending machines wherever they could. To the point of renting out residential electricity. Yeah, like, you agreed to first to let us put a vending machine here and plug it into your household, and we'll pay you the electric and a little bit extra, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like this huge arms race for vending machines.
Interesting phrase, but I do understand, but that's an interesting phraseology. The vending machine arms race.
Yeah, well, once they captured the porn, they had to go for the used underwear.
Right. Right, of course, of course.
The boner pills were already taken.
Indeed. Okay.
So speaking of boner pills.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
And weird stuff out of Japan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have the game I played this week.
I also have the game I played this week, which comes out of Japan.
Yeah, but mine's weirder. It's a silly squid game. It's the Return of Splatoon 3.
Mine's pretty weird, but knock yourself out. Go for it. You already started.
Okay, so this is the DLC for Splatoon 3. Or I should say the second wave of it. Called Side Order. It came out, I guess, like a month ago now. And just where we haven't recorded a ton lately. And also, you know, needing time to spend time with it. I haven't really gotten a chance to talk about it until now. So, story-wise, it's kind of a mess because it references the story mode, the single-player modes, of both the DLC and the main story of Splatoon 2 plus Splatoon 1. So, Cliff Notes version is the protagonist of Side Order is Agent 4, that every time there's a single player, it's, you know, your character's name is like, well, we're just going to call you Agent, yeah, and pick a number, right?
Yeah.
And in the previous game, in the DLC there, they basically got their memories erased through their misadventures. And, okay, every Splatoon game also has a musical group as, like, their centerpiece, all right? The Squid Sisters, Off the Hook, and now Deep Cut for 1, 2, and 3. One of the members of Off the Hook is, like, this elite computer hacker, because of course she is, right?
Of course.
And she is trying to figure out a way to recover the memories of people that are squids that had their memories erased and then condensed down into the what they called memcakes, which was a collectible in the previous Splatoon, and we'll not get too in-depth on this. So she created a virtual world to basically be able to drip feed people their own memories. And they've accidentally created a sentient AI in the process that wants to wipe people's memories and make it so that everything stays exactly the same, because, you know, she was a little upset about losing the last Splatfest, which calls the theming for Splatoon 3 to be anarchy versus order. So, yeah, oopsie, right?
Yeah, whoopsie doodle.
So, in the DLC, you're playing the protagonist from Splatoon 2 trying to recover their memories in a virtual world, all right? And you're trapped there, because of course you are. They've gone full Matrix. And it's a roguelite instead of a proper, like, single-player, third-person shooter with a, like, dedicated levels and everything, like the previous games have been, and including the non-DLC content for Splatoon 3, their single-player content there. Instead, it plays pretty much like you would expect on a roguelite. You face a tower of 30 floors. Each floor, you have an option of three rooms, or three choices of room. And you tackle the rooms one at a time, moving up the tower, fighting bosses along the way. Seems pretty simple, right? And I think that's kind of my problem with the game, is that they have the bones here of a really, really good game, or really good DLC, but they don't do enough with it. So your objectives on each of the floors is one of four different things. There's a just kill selected enemies, kill portals, protect a zone, which is a mode borrowed out of, I should say five things, out of the multiplayer where you have to paint a certain area with your ink, because remember, this is Splatoon, you're shooting ink, because, right?
Right.
Shoot balls to get them into a scoring zone, essentially. Or there's, and now I'm blanking on the fifth one. I just had it and it's on the tip of my tongue and I'm blanking on it, but pretty much all your objectives involve either shooting or protecting something. But the enemy variety is extremely lacking. There's 10 different enemies total, not counting bosses. And there's only a pool of four different bosses, with the end boss being the same every time. It feels a little disappointing that they didn't go more in on this, because there's so much potential here. You start every run with a particular set of weapons, a primary weapon, a secondary, and a special. And as you progress through the levels, your room choice dictates what chip you get to put in your palette. And some of them are very mundane, you know, like a certain percentage of damage increase, you know. Pretty bog standard boring. But then you get more interesting ones, like extremely fast charge speed. Make it so that your squid roll and squid surge actually deal damage. Make it so that if you're running an umbrella, which has a deployable shield, you can no longer launch it, but it makes it so that the shield is more powerful. But at the same time, you're still fighting the same enemies. And at the core of a roguelite, having variety is really king, you know?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it feels more like it's grinding for cosmetics, which, don't get me wrong, does impact gameplay in this, because every time you complete a run with a particular weapon, you're given the virtual, quote-unquote, version of it, which allows you to level it up separately from the normal version. So the first one I completed with, which the, I think it was the bow, and it gives you essentially a second bow that you can level up, which gives you extra weapons licenses, which allows you to buy more weapons for multiplayer faster, plus you get cosmetics that you can take into the multiplayer game, and it's all cosmetic, but at the same time it's gameplay, right? And it's just feels like it's falling a little short, and at the same time overstays its welcome. A run of all 30 floors, assuming you're taking your time and trying to be smart about the rooms and not just rushing and really risking things, takes upwards of an hour and some change, because bosses take a very long time, and it's 30 floors. Even if you take a minute a floor, that's still 30 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And bosses are not taking just 1 minute. I mean, just there's intro sequence takes that long. But at the same time, I'm not hating the game. And I think that's kind of the interesting thing here, where I'm feeling disappointed, but at the same time, I don't actually hate it. It's one of those things that I'll pick up and play a little bit and then put down and not touch it for weeks, which has been the case here. So I would say only really for fans or for people that, just want the cosmetics or the, extra little bit of content. I would love to see them expand this out into a, saying full-priced game is a little bit of a misnomer these days because, oh boy, right? But a more fleshed out experience, you know?
Yeah.
Having it where there's more than just a handful of enemies. With some enemies basically being two enemies combined into, like, one riding the other one. As in, literally that. Or ones that, just shoot slightly faster, right?
Yeah.
I would love to see them flesh this idea out into a more proper title. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like it overstays its welcome, because it doesn't feel like it's too expensive for what it is, because it was, I think it was $20, and it's part of a secondary thing. So, it's not the greatest cost gameplay benefit I've had, but I've enjoyed my time with it. For the most part, just wish there was more. Any questions?
Nope. No questions. I'm not a...
And it feels like I'm one of the odd dissenting voices in this one. Because, oh boy, you look at people talking about it, and it's the best thing since sliced bread. And here I'm thinking, boy, this feels like a diet roguelite.
Yeah. Well, there is a possibility that I could join you, since I now have a Switch again.
Mm-hmm.
Gonna use that to just springboard into
my side. Yeah, we're going to have some Squid Games.
Yeah, I could have some Squid Games, and it could put Switch games onto the Game Club list now. I don't have very many, but so I've talked about this to you. I think I've mentioned it on the show a couple times, but there's a local sort of secondhand shop here called McKay's. They do trading credit for stuff, and I have been taking in trading credit for months and months and months, like stuff to trade in, because my mom, whenever she empties and gets rid of books and movies and whatever, like I sent you a few things. I've kept a few things for myself, but for the most part, like everything that I get goes to McKay's when I make trips down there. So I've got all this trade credit that's built up. And I went in, two weeks ago, with King, after he went to a friend of his birthday party and we were in the area. And we walked in and they had two Switch lights. So I am not interested in the docking capability of the Switch. I never was. And my kid doesn't have a TV in his room, and the only time he plays his Switch so far is when we're like in the car or he's just like sitting downstairs and there's not a TV downstairs. So it's like same kind of boat. Don't need the docking capability. They had two of them. Technically, I mean, literally, I didn't have to pay for them because all the stuff that I got that I traded in came from my mom. So basically, we got two free Switch lights and a couple games. We got four games in total. Because I've got some digital games from when I had purchased them before, but the games that we bought were, let's see, the game that I'm going to talk about, which is Digimon Cyber Sleuth Complete Edition. Yeah, Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth Complete Edition. Got that. Got Mario plus Rabbids again, because I did not finish.
It's not bad.
I did well. I had it before my former friend absconded with my Switch, and I had played through part of it. I don't remember how far I got in the campaign. Then we got a Star Wars. What was it? A Star Wars. It's not like a Star Wars collection, but it has Republic Commando on it and Pod Racer. And there was one other game that my kid picked out, and I cannot remember what it was. Those are the games we've got currently. I've got a few digital games, some freebies, some cheap stuff I got. Stardew Valley.
I have it on Switch and Steam now.
Yeah, I own it on Switch, Steam, and Xbox.
You know, they did just have that big deal. DLC. Update.
They did. And then the next, I'm kind of waiting because my birthday's coming up and I'm gonna see, like, you know, is my family, you know, my parents gonna give me, because usually my mom will go look at my Amazon wish list and buy me something or a couple things off of there. And so I put some Switch stuff on there, a couple Switch games. But like I really want to get the Advanced Warfare remaster, like the 1 and 2 remaster, whatever they did for it. I really want that, but I'm going to wait till after my birthday to see if, like, my mom actually picks that up for me or somebody picks that up for me off my wish list. But anyways, no, the game that I have been playing, though, once I get everything set back up, is a Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth Complete Edition, which is a collection or two games that are sort of a... They're two games that take place during the same time frame and are connected to the same story, but it's sort of like... The original, which covers one perspective through a couple of characters, and then the pseudo-sequel, which covers another portion of the story that supposedly doesn't get explored very much at all, and there's just like a little bit of crossover. I've played... I think you've mentioned this being a problem before. I don't know how much I've played it, because whenever it goes to sleep mode and suspends the game still counts it as like it's running. So my save file says I have like 96 hours played, which is definitely not true. I would guess I've got seven to eight hours into the game. What it is, though, is Digimon, for anyone who's not familiar with Digimon.
Digital monsters?
They're digital monsters. They are the champions.
Of the world.
Does the anime still go? Is it still going?
Actually, I have no idea. I know they did a sequel / reboot at some point.
Yeah, I mean, Digimon was a manga. It was an anime. There have been a number of Digimon games over the years. It was never as popular as Pokemon. But I think it was more popular than Monster Rancher and several of the other kind of monster battling anime that I have seen. But it's the same sort of thing. The game is divided into two parts, the real world and the digital world. And your character specifically, for story reasons, is a digital human hybrid. And so your physical body enters into the digital world of Digimon and then also can exit and roam around the real world of Japan.
Damn.
So...
Wikipedia.
Yeah.
There's a lot more Digimon on here that a lot more Digimon anime produced than I knew about.
I knew of like two or three series.
There's nine series.
Okay. Well,
The last one was last aired last year. There was a lot of last there. With a total of 519 episodes.
Damn. Hey, you know what? Good for them. I think
Digimon hit a problem in the U.S. where it came out, I'm pretty sure, like a year or two after Pokemon, or somewhere in that time frame, and it just got kind of latched onto as a knockoff. Although the anime, from what I recall, was a lot more serious, is not the proper term, but less silly. How about that?
Yeah. But so the game, I will say, like, you do not need to know anything about Digimon to play this game. The first hour to 2 hours, actually, let me back up one step for a second. The order that you should play them in is Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth. That's the first one. And then Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth Hacker's Memory, which is the sequel, midquel, whatever you want to call it. You can play either one of them first, but my understanding from what I read online is that, like, the story doesn't make as much sense if you don't play Cyber Sleuth first, because Hacker's Memory assumes that you have. And so there are details, especially in the beginning of the game, that it just glosses over. It still does kind of a basic introduction in case someone does come to that game first and they don't know anything about Digimon, but... otherwise, like it assumes that you have played the first one and know some stuff about it, so that
this is a Digimon. Do not put it in your pocket.
Yeah,
it's a different mon.
Yes, but anyways, so the game does like tell you like early on, like, hey, you can play both of these at the same time if you want, and you can just transfer your Digimon back and forth between the two games. But also, there's an import feature, so if you beat the first one, you can just import all of your Digimon straight away into the second one. Which I would imagine absolutely destroys gameplay progression in the second one, but who knows? Maybe they accounted for that. Digimon, the game is broken up into kind of... There's the real world and the digital world, and that kind of separates the two portions of the game. Because of story reasons, and honestly some stuff that I really don't understand yet, you wind up working for a digital detective. The lady is not digital, but like she has a digital detective agency, and so she solves crime by doing digital detective work. And you interact with stores, human characters, sort of the world at large, to go to certain places where you need to like, you know, there's like a shopping mall you go to, and it's like, oh, there's something wrong with the central heating and air system, and oh, it's a Digimon that's in there. You got to find out what's wrong and why there's a Digimon there that's ruining the central heat and air system. So it's like you go in the real world map to that place and do that, or you're trying to track someone down. And it's like, okay, well, they were, you know, in this park. So go to the park and interact with, you know, the public access terminal here in the park and find evidence of them, and then go to the subway station. And, you know, so that's kind of how it breaks it up. The real world, do your shopping, do your inventory management, do kind of any kind of management stuff in advance, the overworld plot, and then going into the digital world is where you do the other portion of the game, which is managing your Digimon and fighting or battling. There is a, oh, I forget what it's called, but there's like a safe zone that you can go to because you're a special hacker boy and girl. who, you know, you've got a special connection to your Digimon somehow. It's never explained, or if it was, I missed it.
Pervert.
And, oh, there's some people early on in like a side mission that like they absolutely are Digimon perverts, and you have to like beat them in fights so that they learn the error of their ways and stop being such an internet degenerate, which is quite humorous. But I just think that was an interesting way to handle that situation. But anyways, there, you know, there's like a safe zone where you can go to, and there are some things you can interact with. You there's like a farm where that you can put your Digimon on it, and they can do various tasks. They can train to level up. They can farm like special unique items and equipment. They can rest and recover, which like helps them level up faster. And then just generally you can boost their stats by letting them like be on the farm for a while, and you can expand the farm size. You can get multiple farm plots so that you can do different things at once. And it's pretty integral actually, because one of the things that you have to do is have your Digimon like go to the farm and like investigate. So it's like a cyber farm, I guess. It's like, hey, find jobs for me to do, please. Go scour the internet for jobs for me to do.
Oh, great. Now the farm is a sweatshop in India.
Oh, no. Oh. Then you've got...
We're sending your Digimon to a nice farm upstate where they'll be working 20 hours a day. But they get their MP bottle. They no longer have to share.
There you go. But you get this thing called the Digibank, which... Collecting Digimon, you capture Digimon differently than how you do Pokemon. Whenever you battle Digimon, you're able to scan them. And the scanning happens, like, there's a base scan you get automatically, and then I think there's a way that you can scan them for additional data that I don't have unlocked yet, or I'm doing something wrong to get, because it never seems to work. But whenever you fight Digimon, you get a scan of them. You collect some data. And once you collect 100% of data on a Digimon, you can hatch it from a Digi-Egg, and then you get like a baby Digimon or a copy of that Digimon. And then the process repeats so that you can farm Digimon because you need to like Digi-Shred them. That's not what it's called, but that's what it does. You like Digi-Shred them so that you can like Digi steroid shot up your other Digimon that you want to make more powerful so that you can get them to the level up requirement so that they can evolve into the next higher Digimon. It's like, it's wild.
It's still a lot kinder than Power World, where you just beat them into submission with a stick.
That's true. And then like carve them up to serve them to your other pals. But so, yeah, so there's this process you go through of farming Digimon data so that you can, like, literally farm Digimon and then, you know, munch them down and feed them to your favorite Digimon so they get strong enough to level up and evolve. Every Digimon goes through evolutions just like how Pokemon do, but you get to pick the evolution and there are requirements. As you expand your, like, Digidex, it's called something else, but I mean, it's like a Pokedex, but for Digimon. So Digidex, as you expand your Digidex, you can just see what Digimon they can evolve into. But in the beginning, when you don't have anything, it's all just kind of like random guesswork based on like the silhouette and like a brief description of what they need to achieve to be able to become that Digimon. And you can level them up, and every time you can evolve them rather. And every time you evolve them, it resets the level back to one. It raises the level cap that they can become, and it increases the stat cap so that they can become stronger. And there are requirements to level up your Digimon. And early on, every Digimon can level up, like, or can evolve 2-3 times before they start hitting things that are impossible for them to achieve until you de-evolve them and re-evolve them to get that cap up. And doing that normally is extremely slow, because you can Digi-de-evolve at will for free, but it resets them to level 1 at the previous evolution. And so if the requirement to get the Digimon you want, like, let's say that you have to get to level 30, before you can level up into the Digimon that you want. Then that cap resets, and then the next thing you have to get is, like, level 50. The first 10, 12 levels are, like, super fast. So you get, like, a bunch of health, a bunch of attacks, and some special moves, like, really quickly, within, like, a couple of battles or, like, one or two training sessions on the farm. But then it really slows down. And so that's where munching up your unwanted digi-slaves and feeding them Soylent Green style to your Digimon to level them up faster.
If you want to have fun, if you want to have a fun drinking game, go back and take a shot every time you said that Jared said the word digi.
Yeah, you'll digi be dead. You'll be dead really quickly. Good luck, though. I mean, I guess if you want to die, that's one way to do it. But yeah, so that's the whole process, and I'm just starting to get into the initial curves of that. The only Digimon that I really the Digimon that I use are the cute ones. I try to evolve my Digimon into one that looks cute, because I don't really know anything about Digimon. I remember a couple from when I watched the show. Agumon is like a little guy that looks kind of like Charizard, and I kind of like him. And I remember he turns into like a robot T-Rex thing that can breathe fire later. So I'm like trying to level him up and find the robot T-Rex thing. But like otherwise, like I just keep rotating out my team of like who's cute and isn't like just a little goo ball. Because all of the like baby Digimon are just like little like goo balls of different colors. Which I guess is kind of cute, but you know, they're real weak. They have got real low stat caps. And that's just kind of the process. You have three active Digimon at a time in your team that are battling. You can have up to six reserve Digimon that you can swap to at will, and they gain experience even if they're not in your main roster, but it's at a reduced rate. So you can, you know, drag Digimon around with you for no reason other than to just like level them up, you know, piggybacking experience. But you're capped. You have like a certain amount of points that you can spend. I think it doesn't call it. It's like it's not RAM. It gives it another thing, but it's like, you know, you have 25 gigabytes of RAM or whatever. And so Digimon take up RAM and you have to build your team within that limit. And there's ways to increase it as you go through the game, items and certain other things you can level up. But that's kind of your limiting factor. So technically you can carry 9 Digimon with you at the beginning of that of the game. That means you have like a whole team of like squishy blob boys. I can only have 4 Digimon with me at a time. 1 squishy blob boy and then like 3 good Digimon. And my team roster is full. There's an online battle system, which nobody uses at this point, because you have to have the Nintendo paid online service for it to work.
Mm-hmm.
You can do local network battles though, but we only have 1 copy, so I can't fight my kids' digi things.
Slaughter them.
Yeah. And then there's the battle system itself, which I'm in 2 minds about. It plays more like a traditional JRPG, fully turn-based. You can see the action economy of who's going to go next anytime you pick a move that maybe might affect that by making your enemy slower or you faster. You can see it update kind of on the fly. But so far, 99% of the battles are so easy. I either just push the auto battle button and just let them fight until it's done, or I spam the A button to just do normal attacks because I don't want to use up any of my Digimon's like SP. Mm-hmm. There have been like 3 fights so far in the entire game that I'm like, okay, I need to look at this. Because there's the whole rock, paper, scissors thing. There's different types, you know, fire, water, grass, normal. So, you know, there's different types. There's
Intel, AMD.
There's like virus and program and like a couple others that are like computer specific, like, you know, quote unquote hacker terms.
Yeah, Sound Blaster.
Nice. But yeah, you know, there's that whole rock, paper, scissors thing going on. And of course, like I said, there are moves that can buff and debuff and whatnot. But three battles, I've paid attention to that. And the rest of the time, I'm just like, okay, spam A to do normal attacks as fast as possible, or just press the plus symbol, which is what turns on and off auto battle. And just turn it on and then leave them to fight. that's pretty much it. I mean, you solve, you know, there's a story, there's an overarching story, but a whole bunch of the game is like based around you grinding your Digimon to make them stronger and collecting all the Digimon. So there's a whole bunch of side quests that are investigations. You can turn up infinite sort of procedural quests by having your Digimon do the like investigation mission on the farm. And then there's a repeatable like battle thing you can do, like a tournament with other NPCs in the game and their like Digimon rosters. And as far as I can tell, that seems infinitely repeatable. There might be a cap on it, but if there is, I haven't got there yet. So far, I haven't lost a single match against the AI. So it's, there's pros and cons. I like it. I think it's fun. There's a lot of like kind of silly, like weeby, like teenage Japanese humor on there that I can kind of vibe with. The characters are pretty interesting. They're pretty tropey, like anime tropey, but that's okay. I think that's fine. And I think a lot of the Digimon are cute. So far, that has all been enough to hold me over. But I'm like 8 hours in. The game is only just now starting to open up. And even then, it's like crawling at a glacial pace. One gripe before I'm done and we can move on. It has tank-style controls.
Why? With
fixed cameras. Camera angles.
Oh.
Good question. I don't know. This game came out in, I think, 2015. It was on PlayStation originally. I'm not sure if it was on the PSP or PS4 first, but still, both of those games should be able to have a fully rotatable camera. So there are times that the tank control thing is like, God damn it. I was pushing down, and now I'm going back and forth through the same area, and I've triggered a random battle. There are times when that has happened, and that's really frustrating. But battles are so easy, it's like, well, I guess I'll just hit auto battle and get some Digi data. I think that's the biggest thing. Like, if it bothers you that the battles are really easy and you don't have to think about them and you're just like skipping through them, you're going to hate this because there's a lot of grinding with few major battles so far that you have to pay attention to, you know, between a lot of time between those. So if you being like, oh, the battle system sucks, I'm not interested. Fair enough. That's a lot of the game. You're going to be running around the same, like, four digital areas, being like, God, when is this gate going to unlock? Let me go, like, just club some more seals as my, like, horned T-Rex shoots fireballs at the little squishy guy, Ogremon. He's just a fucking green guy with a club. Anyways. B minus, maybe? But I'm having fun with it, so it's nice.
Sounds about in the tier for Sound Order.
Yeah. And, you know, it's on sale all the time. It's also available on Steam. I actually own this game on Steam per the recommendation of some of my other friends. It was on sale for like $5 during the spring sale. And my friends were like, oh, you should buy this. Like, it's great. We love it. You're a huge weeb. You'll like it. And they're right. I'm just past the automatic refund point for it on Steam. I'm going to see if I can get a refund, but if I can't, it's okay. So, yeah. But that's it. That's your game, my game.
Mm-hmm.
So, to the news.
Right.
Yeah. Our first topic, Stop Killing Games, is a new campaign to prevent publishers from taking their titles offline.
I mean... Right? Stop killing your goddamn games. Let us play them. I'm trying to recall if I'm subscribed to this guy, but this is a major YouTuber that's leading this campaign. And kind of the crux of this is the crew going offline in the past week or so. Which, the first crew game sold millions and millions and millions of copies. And now they're all just pointless, yeah. They're sitting in people's libraries and you can't play them. And the thing is that the crew had a pretty extensive single-player content or campaign that you can't access because the servers are offline, because it requires online connection, even if you're just doing the single player missions.
Yeah.
Which is such bullshit to begin with.
Yep. According to the article, like three paragraphs in, mm-hmm. says the campaign's goal is to convince authorities to examine the legality of this practice and hopefully pass legislation to end, as it represents an assault on both consumer rights and preservation of media. The crew is said to have had a player base of 12 million people when it was taken offline, making this an ideal opportunity to hold a AAA publisher responsible for their actions. It doesn't say, I'm guessing that that is not active. That means a like player pool of 12 mm-hmm. million people.
Yeah, which we both would be encountered in, because, right?
Yeah, we both own the crew and have played it previously.
Yeah, I think it was given away at one point, so it does have a very inflated player base. But it was also very popular for quite a while. And then they moved on to a sequel that kind of missed the point of the idea of it, you know? By introducing airplanes. And now they're just going full-on Forza Horizon clone.
Yeah.
Which, don't get me wrong, I do enjoy my Forza Horizon, but the crew already was very arcadey. I don't need over-the-top arcade like Horizon. If I wanted Horizon, I'd be playing Horizon, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's not to say that they can try, but yeah, it once again feels like the Diet Cola, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, I've had this, like, roller coaster. Like, maybe roller coaster is a bit of an exaggeration, but I have mixed feelings about this. Not in the sense that, like, is it good? Is it bad? Like, no, it's bad. But my mixed feelings come from, like, I was a huge, like, early adopter of, like, yeah, all digital media. This will be great. What could go wrong with it? Here's what could go wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I switched to almost exclusively digital-only game, like, digital-only media in, I'm going to say, 08, 09. back when there were, you know, still, like, I guess there's been a couple in, you know, the last few years, last decade, maybe, depending on when GOG came online. But, you know, back in the days where it's, like, everybody had their own, like, game store, you know, where you could buy digital games, and trying to consolidate that before Steam was king, and then buying games on, like, the Xbox, on Xbox Live, when it was the Xbox Live Arcade, I think, where you could get, like, a bunch of smaller games, and then they start offering digital purchases of games, but I have been a huge, like, digital-only person for forever. I hate having, like, too much physical stuff. But, man, you know, sometimes I'm like, you know, I've got a disk drive that I could just, like, pop my case open and slide it in there. There's a whole world of media I could gain access to with a disk drive.
Yeah, but the thing is that this is really a symptom of digital gaming. This is a symptom of always online gaming. Because, you know, the crew had a physical version. This is just another point of developers chasing the newest, shiniest thing while still forcing online DRM, because that's, at the end of the day, what at least part of this is.
Yeah.
And whenever it's no longer financially viable, or it's not viable enough, because that's also the other part of this, is just the greed component where, it's not making enough money. It's still, it's not costing them money, but it's not making enough money. And they can write off sunsetting the servers as a tax write-off, or they can move that hardware to something else. And, I just look at older games that, while, yes, they still had digital footprints or digital versions, they still were physical as well, and they still have this problem. Let's pick one almost at random. Darkspore. Darkspore is the sequel to Spore, which was a roguelite-ish game, but it was always online, even if you played single player only. And it's been dead for years now because EA pulled the plug on the servers. Can't play it at all now. Although, to be fair, that's not a great loss. But the point still stands.
Yeah.
What we really need, and the U.S. is not going to do this, because this requires far too much demanding of corporations. And at the end of the day, corporations own the government through both legal and shady means. Which, boy, that sounds like I'm wrapping myself in tinfoil and being conspiracy theorist. But no, look up lobbyists, right?
Yeah.
There is far too much money in politics for consumer protection to really be at the forefront of most politicians' minds. Not all of them. I'm not saying every single politician is in the pocket of corporations, but they seem few and far between these days, you know?
Yeah.
And while I would love to see legislation passed to protect games as an art form, to be able to go back and play these games, or at least make it so that whenever a game is sunset like this, they put out the server code so that legal copies could communicate with one another. There's far too much behind the scenes, I think, to really be able to make that, one, viable. But also, why would they want to do that whenever it might take attention away from the new shiny thing?
Yeah.
Now, we've seen corporations sit on IPs for decades and shoot down fan games and fan projects because they might someday want to make that game again, you know?
Yeah.
I hate to be the cynic. Actually, no, that's not true. I like being the cynic. But I wish I didn't have to be at this point.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. You like to be the cynic, but it sucks to kind of always be the cynic.
Wish they would prove me wrong.
You articulated what I was trying to say, I think, a little bit better, just because I'm, like, got a little hung up on my own, like, history of, like, games and sort of the evolution of digital gaming and always into always online requirements. But, yeah. I find myself playing games and looking at games like more and more these days of like, well, could I play this game like 10 years from now when I decide to come back to it randomly? And if the answer is no, I'm less likely to buy it, especially if it's going to cost me, any significant amount of money. So there's a few exceptions here or there, but let's see. I've installed some games that, looking at my Steam library for what's installed right now. I installed Star Wars Empire at War Gold Pack because I wanted to play that game again. I believe that game came out originally in, like, the early to mid-2000s, and the last time I played it was in 2017. But, like, on Steam I've only played that game for 12 and a half hours, but in total, from the two or three times I've owned that game, a couple hundred hours, a few hundred hours maybe. So, yeah. Like, stuff like that, like, has a lot more value to me than it used to. But, anyways, yeah. Excuse me. Are you ready to move on to our last news topic?
Yeah. Okay.
Our other news topic? Yeah, so, our other news topic of the night.
Yeah, we didn't really dive into the community stuff, but we'll save that for next week because it's going to be a late one anyway. We do have some stuff from Jim, and I don't think we want to be here all night. So Jim, we do see your Roblox stuff, but we're going to save that for when we're fresh. How about that?
Yeah. So yeah, how hidden Nazi symbols were the tip of toxic iceberg at Life is Strange developer Deck 9. This was the subject of this week's Jimquisition, which unfortunately neither of us have watched, so we're just going to diving in on this article. We may very well be back here to talk about this later, but it's like, the Nazis are out. Like, we gotta like stand up and be like, look at the Nazis, punch them.
Yeah, I really miss a time when the racist assholes didn't feel so empowered.
Yeah.
Because for a while there, things weren't great, but people were starting to talk back whenever people were being racist, sexist, homophobic assholes. And then, you know, mid-2010s, you know, just slightly past the midpoint there, you know, they got a... what? picking a date almost at random? The assholes decided to come out of the woodworks, and oh boy.
Yep. The article is... The article that we have, anyways, the one that we're looking at, is fairly lengthy. I had skimmed through it earlier, and I'm kind of skimming back and forth through it now. It seems like to make a long story short, for the moment at least, is that it seems like in at some point in the development, and it might say a specific date that I missed, some staff members started noticing like weird amounts of racist dog whistle stuff, a meme here or there, numbers or symbols that are a little bit less overt than just like a swastika that they found. And initially it was like, oh, that's a weird coincidence or a weird mistake. But as they found more and more examples, the staff that were discovering them and realized what they were and were uncomfortable with them sort of ignored, that management didn't really do anything about it, and that progressed for some time. Looks like there's some internal issues with the company, as there's some unrest, and like understandably so, like if you're working with people and it's like, hey, this is Nazi shit, like, and we're not making a World War II game, we're not making a game that like directly deals with the Nazis, and you've got Nazi shit here. And then nothing happens. Mm-hmm. Like, I would not be comfy. I wouldn't want to stay around there.
That's kind of a shame that Life is Strange ended up with these guys, because we both were very praising the first game.
And lots of people have praised a lot of their games for realistic, healthy, adequate portrayal of marginalized people or difficult and intense situations, and they've got a lot of symbolism in their games anyways. Like, there's a lot of messages that are kind of on the nose about you know, the queer communities and struggles that people with mental illnesses face, and you know, etc. There's plenty of subtext too, so it's not like that there's no subtext in these games and that somebody or some groups of people wouldn't notice like harmful subtextual imagery and messaging.
Or like, gee, the number 88 is popping up a lot, right?
Yeah, it's like, this feels weird, what is this? Oh, I see. In the article, and like, this is pretty near the top, this says, according to over a dozen current and former employees across several departments, most of whom spoke to me on the condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal, Deck Nine's management has long let toxic work culture fester at the studio. They claim the C-suite has produced multiple abusive leaders, encouraged crunch, and allowed bullying of individuals advocating internally for a more authentic representation in Life is Strange. So, not a new problem.
Although, here's one that's intriguing. Just under, like, an eighth of the way down. For instance, multiple people recalled an incident during True Colors development where Square Enix told multiple developers it didn't want Life is Strange to be thought of as the gay game. Sounds like Square Enix is also way out of touch, huh?
Yeah. How badly were they not paying attention to the room? Like, you know, read the room, buddy. Doesn't take a degree to notice where the wind is blowing.
Even our press guides, we were not to say anything about Alex's sexuality, period, at all. This is from True Colors, the third Life is Strange, or fourth, depending on how where you put Before the Storm.
Yeah.
It's sad to see just... yet another developer being absolute pieces of shit behind the scenes, and now it's coming up, and it makes me not really want to touch Life is Strange again, even though I do have Life is Strange 2, and I've had it and not played it because it feels like it would be a great Game Club game, you know?
Yeah. I'm so cynical now. I don't know. Like, I would imagine there was a time where this kind of stuff was surprising to me, but, like, it has not been surprising to me for a long time. And again, like, I think at most of these places, most of the people are somewhere between good and fine. If there weren't good, thoughtful, introspective people working at these studios, or, you know, I guess in this example, working at this studio in particular, like, Life is Strange would not exist and would not be the game that it was. Like, I think most of the people are good, but whenever people who are, I see this, but, like, in my work as well, people who are abusers, people who are narcissists, people who are, you know, these types of people, they're very good at getting into positions where they have some power over someone else. And then they exercise it. They exercise it to be unkind, unhelpful, or just generally, like, do harm because it makes them feel good to be in charge. And I'm making a bit of a generalization about some stuff that's going on here. But it's like these people worm their way into the echelons of power, like, everywhere. Every game studio, every film studio, every company that is large enough, like, has these people in it. And I'm just not surprised anymore. I'm not surprised that a lot of really talented, introspective, thoughtful developers are being hamstrung by, relatively speaking, like, a handful of racist, sexist assholes. And I hate that. I hate that I'm like, oh, yep, it's another one. Sucks that it's this studio. Oh, well. Like, I hate that that's my feeling on it.
I mean, we also both live in the South, so it's also, I think, less surprising to us.
Yeah.
In very, very, very red states. I don't think I'm surprised. I'm more just disappointed, because it makes me want to step back from a series that I look forward to diving back into.
Yeah.
Especially since Don't Nod is pretty much completely all hands off with Life is Strange now, and they're doing their own thing. And it seems like disappointing us there, but that's Game Club.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I still think at some point I'm going to play the Life is Strange games. I want to honor the people who, like I said in that spiel I just made, I want to honor the people who are talented and worked hard and were introspective and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I might be less inclined to pay full price for them. And depending, I guess, on how the situation turns out, I may be less inclined to pay for them at all. But I would still like to play the games. Maybe. Yeah, I'm in a different position than I used to be. I might find, if there are individuals who have broken off, or, you know, other sort of projects, other ways to support the... to just simplify it, the good people here, I might do that, and then just, you know, pirate the Life is Strange games. That way, none of my money goes to, you know, a shitty studio. But that's...
I mean, you could always donate to LGBTQ charity.
Yeah, that doesn't directly help the people, though, who are making the games.
I know.
It's tough. There's no ethical consumption under capitalism. Let me just get up on my, you know, on my soapbox here. I won't. I'm not going to do that. But is it, like, this just feels like one of those bad situations. Why has it got to be Nazi shit? I mean, not that, like, other stuff is necessarily, like, better. You know, like, other forms of racism and sexism are not good. But, like, Nazi shit is always the worst. I have such a, like, I never liked Nazis, right? Like, I was never, you know, never into that stuff.
Well, I did like shooting them.
Yeah. And other than, like, from a historical perspective, or from, you know, my sort of, one of my side fascinations with, like, military history. Like, other than that, like, I never was like, oh, yeah, the Nazis, they were pretty cool, right? Like, sucks that Hitler was so bad, but the Nazis, like, that was never, like, my, you know, that's never been my vibe. But
I gotta say one thing before we move on. Hitler did do one thing I approve of. He shot Hitler.
He shot Hitler. Yeah, way to go, Hitler. There was that for that. That makes me think. There's a sketch, and I can't remember who did it. And you might have seen it before, but it's like a guy goes back in time. He's a time traveler, and he goes to kill someone. And like, it's not Hitler. It's like a guy who did an atrocity, and it's like, yeah, I killed the guy, and I stopped the atrocity, which was, you know, it wasn't good. Mm-hmm. It was still like 1,000 dead Jews or something, like a massacre. And I'm like, oh, well, when you killed that guy, that means we got this guy, and it's Hitler.
Mm-hmm. Okay, like, since we're on Hitler now, one of my favorite writing prompts on r/writing prompts. I think it's the top one. I want to make sure I get it worded right. Writing prompts is just a short, like, prompt to write a short story, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. It's the top one of all time on r/writing prompt, so it'd be really easy to find. The year is 1910. Adolf Hitler, a struggling artist, has fought off dozens of assassination attempts by well-meaning time travelers, but this one is different. This traveler doesn't want to kill Hitler. He wants to teach him to paint. He pulls off his hood to reveal a fuzzy afro. He is Bob Ross.
Aww.
It's from 7 years ago, and it just has amazing stories on it.
Yeah, I may look that up later. Not later tonight, but just like later. That sounds really intriguing. But yeah, Nazi stuff just hits different because of the last 8-10 years in America. So, although speaking of Nazi stuff in like a different kind of way, like Band of Brothers has been showing up like crazy in my YouTube recommendations. I don't know what has got the YouTube algorithm going like, yeah, Band of Brothers, that's a good show. But like, it is, and I kind of want to watch Band of Brothers again.
See some Nazis get killed.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a big kerfuffle in the last Wolfenstein game that came up that they were killing Nazis?
Oh, I don't remember that. Was there?
If it wasn't latest Wolfenstein with the twins, it was another, you know, World War II or alternate history game where they were shooting Nazis, and it was like, this game is bad because it's killing Nazis. And I'm blanking on if it was Wolfenstein or what, but it's just, politics in the U.S. is utterly and completely fucked.
I'm now reading an article from 2017. So what's the big deal? This is like in the middle of an article. People are upset that the game is about, you guessed it, killing Nazis. Some people are even taking the anti-Nazi. Right about Wolfenstein. Yeah, it's Wolfenstein. Some people are even taking the anti-Nazi, anti-fascism stance as a personal attack against Trump and Trump supporters. So much so that they believe the game itself is a form of hidden message within the franchise that fans of the series should go out and kill Nazis. This is from October 10th, 2017, after Wolfenstein, what was it, Wolfenstein The New Order, which was the second of the Wolfenstein reboot, whatever that they did. I think it was Wolfenstein The New Order. Anyways, yeah.
Just ridiculous, huh?
This made it into Newsweek. Nazi killing video game Wolfenstein 2 angers Nazis with Make America Nazi Free Again slogan. The article opens with, it's a hell of a time in America when a video game taking an anti-Nazi stance is considered by some to be too controversial. Yet, here we are. Although, absolutely, Make America Nazi Free. As an aside, now that we're here, right? We should really wrap up soon because it's almost midnight. But
yeah.
As an aside, in Wolfenstein 2, whatever it is, New Colossus or New Order or whatever, there's the scene, I guess spoilers, where that BJ meets Hitler, like 1960s Hitler.
Yeah, cut down his fucking skull, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I don't remember if they say if it's coke or not. Maybe they do, but like he's drugged out of his mind. Like he pisses on the rug or something in front of all of them. He winds up like killing a dude, but like just like randomly, like he pitches a tantrum and like shoots a guy in the face. And that portrayal of Hitler is really interesting because, like, you know, propaganda of the era, and even a lot of really up until I think the mid 2010s, everything that you saw about Hitler was like, oh yes, he was, you know, he was very, very intelligent, very smart, very this or that. You know, he made some unfortunately rather.
And Ha's a fucking type.
Yeah, he made some rather large blunders in his hubris, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's like, here, relatively recently, within, I guess, the last decade, where there's been, I don't know if, like, a revision or, like, with modern-day historians, I've heard them referred to as the YouTube historians, who are really passionate about this and always have been, and are like, no, all of this was bullshit. Here's all of the documents that we have in all of these libraries and all of these archives that show that like Hitler was an incompetent idiot who was partly like who happened to be extremely charismatic, but he was such a narcissist that he just could not handle real decisions, real power, real criticism. And it's like, huh. That's a really insightful portrayal of Hitler, because that was right before that sort of revision that I'm aware of started to happen in more modern presentations of Hitler and World War II. And also the comparison to Trump is like apt, right? Like the comparison is made all the time.
Well, there's not enough adult diapers, but still.
The comparison is made frequently between Trump and Hitler. And I do think the comparison is apt, but not for the reasons that most people seem to think about. Because they, you know, they focus on the Nazi shit and the hateful shit. And like, yeah, absolutely. You know, those things are present. But also, like, the incompetence, the childishness, the tantrums.
Where's the charisma?
He is extremely, like, because we're both, like, critical thinkers and we're not within that demographic, to us, it's bullshit, but he is extremely charismatic to the people that's what they think like leadership is. And that's what charisma is anyways, just being able to convince somebody, anybody, that you're likable or attractive or interesting or whatever, you know, whatever your goal is, being able to convince somebody. At the end of the day, that's what charisma is. And just because we're not the target audience doesn't mean that he's not a charismatic man. And he's extremely charismatic to his target audience. It just sucks that they're all ignorant assholes. It's been a long time since we've gotten really political on the show.
And yet here we are.
Fuck Nazis, man. Actually, don't fuck Nazis. Let's not breed Nazis. Punch Nazis as hard as you can in
the dick.
In the dick. And I guess if they're lady Nazis, punch them...
They're still dicks.
Right. Give him a swift kick in the vagina. I said it weird like that on purpose. You can cringe. That's fine.
Oh, don't worry. I cringe quite a bit around you.
Good to know. Good to know. So, yeah. Are we ready to take us home, Rage? Ready to tell everybody them socials?
Yeah. And we'll catch up on community stuff next week, because I kind of had a feeling that things were going to go off the rails.
Yeah. Good feeling.
So, yeah, we'll catch up next week. Once again, if you wish to send us stuff, which we will definitely get a hold of, which we did cover some community stuff inadvertently.
Yeah.
It wasn't the Nazi shit, it was the other shit. The Stop Killing Video Games was also Community Corner. But I just linked to an article that gave a little bit more context. If you wish to send us stuff, though, you can do so at vgopodcast@gmail.com with your letters, voicemails, game-related topics. Tweet us vgopodcast or drop us a link over on Discord in that sub-Discord channel? Well, what's the proper term for that? Oh, no, I'm far too tired.
Discord channel, yeah.
Yeah, it's Channel 4, right?
Absolutely.
Which you can find a link to that over at the top of VGLpodcast.podbean.com, which is paid for by our lovely, lovely patrons. VGLpodcast.podbean.com. And if you're to spread the love, you can find us on your podcatcher of choice. Our intro and outro music is On the Ground by Kevin McLeod. You can find his work over at incompetech.com. And
as always, as his lovely music starts to roll across my voice, bye-bye now.
See ya.
Bye-bye.